Welcome to the Mind and Clip Theology Podcast, hosted by Miriam Peace and Amy Panton, which come out of the Canadian Journal of Theology, Mental Health, and Disability.
We both live and work on lands that have been homes and remain homes to the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, the Neutral, and the Ojibwe Chippewa peoples and other peoples who have cared for the land.
We are grateful for the opportunity to live and work on this land and are mindful of the need to repair broken covenants.
This podcast is an opportunity to model how faith communities can engage in theological and spiritual conversations around madness and crippedness.
If you need a full transcript, you can find our videos on our YouTube channel.
We want to say before we begin that topics and conversations we are raising throughout our time together are often hard.
They are hard for Mad and Clip people ourselves, and hard for our families and loved ones.
So do what you need to do to take care of yourselves, your bodies, minds, and hearts.
And now, here is our episode.
Everybody, we can go around and do introductions. So Miriam has put that in the chat for all of you, so you can see what we'd like you to mention for our listeners. So your name, your pronouns, your work or your academic location, wherever you find yourself. Your connection to mental health and disability, whatever that might be for you, and then also the connection to the journal. So how do we know you? How do we know each other? So thanks. I think what we'll do is we might do this by mutual invitation. So when you have finished, you can invite the next person. So I'm going to invite Hiran to begin. Okay. Thank you so much, Hiran. Yeah.
Thank you, Amy and Miriam. It's wonderful. I'm just so excited about the journal and being invited to this. It's such an honor. My name is Hiran Kim Craig. I pronounce she, her, hers. I'm at Emmanuel. I teach homiletics, but I'm a very intersectional thinker and doing homiletics in a very interdisciplinary way, and especially in light of post-colonial lens. So that's I am. Anything else I need to say here?
What you offered to the journal.
One of my jobs at Emmanuel is a graduate studies director. So I'm so proud and honored to have Miriam and Amy as our PhD students. So when this journal was percolating in the conversation, I was totally pumped as a GD person supporting our PhD students. And I mean, this is really exemplary and excelling of our students being already into the academic field. And so that's what I got into, interested in the journal. As I said, you know, I care about my field in homiletics and worship and education. You know, when we want to be effective preachers, you need to really reflect and know where people are at in terms of their lived experiences. And those lived experiences are often not always happy and joyful, right? Because human life's never just that. So there's always issues with the difficulties and challenges. And so mental illness and health are part of really subject matters of homiletics, in my view. And so, and, you know, race and gender, you know, class and ability and age and you name it, those are, you know, just really multifaceted identities that we all navigate to perform. And so that's how I really got interested in this journal.
And can you invite?
May I invite Chelsea?
Sure, thank you so much. I apologize, I'll change my name. I actually go by Elizabeth. don't be sorry, it's not your fault. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a first year PhD student at Western University. And my research takes up using critical discourse analysis to look at attendance services policies and how those shape who can and cannot access services using able, disabled constructs. I'm really fortunate. I came to this journal through a conversation about a year ago that Miriam and Amy came to do for NEEDS, which is National Educational Association of Disabled Students. And I am fortunate enough to be a research consultant with NEEDS, and I was invited. And so I heard about this work and then reached out to my co-author, Alexa, yay, to prepare a piece. And I think how I come to, I guess, disability and mental health. I'd like to offer another term. I don't identify with lived experience. I say that I have experiential knowledge of disability because it looks at not only my experience of living with a disability, but my experience in scholarship and my experience interacting in the community and in society, but it also critically, experiential knowledge critically takes up how disability is enacted and socially constructed. So it's a bit broader. So for me, I identify as having experiential knowledge of disability, and I'm going to pass it on to Alexa.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. It is really good to be with all of you today. My name is Alexa Gilmore, and I use she, her, hers as my pronouns. I am the minister of Windermere United Church, which is in the west end of Toronto. And similar to what Hayran was saying around intersectionality, that's a big part of my focus and passion. And how do we break through some of those silos? And a church is a place where different identities intersect. And there are a variety of lived experiences that we can learn from, be in relationship with, stand in solidarity with one another, be transformed into sort of, in terms of theological language, that kingdom of God experience as we do learn with each other. And I was invited to be part of the journal through Elizabeth, who said, we've got this story to tell. And that was the first I'd heard about the journal, and I got very excited about the journal because I don't think there's anything like it, and there's a need. So very, very excited for the journals to come in the following months, and really grateful to be here.
Thank you so much. We wondered if you could take a brief moment to talk a bit about your thesis. We assume all the listeners and watchers have read your wonderful work, but just a brief word on what you wrote about for this time. So maybe Elizabeth and Alexa can start us off. So Elizabeth, I know you were the driving force behind this, so how about you begin?
Okay, I'll begin. I just want to acknowledge before I begin that this piece is based on a program called Neighbors Helping Neighbors, which has so many hands that have reached out to be a part of it. So I would be remiss if I didn't say that this program is because of so many in our community. I think, you know, like our piece says, like when COVID started, which seems like forever ago, I know myself, I was kind of sitting at home and, you know, I hadn't started PhD school land yet. So when work finished at 5 o'clock, I needed something to do. I had a really busy life prior to COVID with activism and advocacy work, and I needed something to keep my idle hands busy. And so I had kind of heard through the church, through Windermere, that this great program was starting, Neighbors Helping Neighbors. And I was one of the people that helped to get it off the ground along with many others. And I think, you know, what our piece touches on is the importance of community and the importance of collectives of care. But I think also touches on bigger questions around where our society has not stepped up to provide support for people with disabilities, certainly in the pandemic, but even pre-pandemic. And I think a lot of that is really exemplified around supports for home care, financial support. I think there's a lot of feeling, certainly for myself and from others in the community that I consider allies and friends, that we're disposable, you know, that we feel really sort of silenced by structures. And I've started to think about, I don't really like the term barriers, like when people say, well, there's a barrier to people finding education or employment. I actually think it's structural violence, like it's bigger mm-hmm. systemic issues that are actually working to indirectly cause violence to individuals. So I think about OVSP and how that keeps people in poverty. So to me, those aren't barriers, they're structural instances of structural violence. So I think I'll leave it there. And I really want to acknowledge Alexa and give her a chance to speak as well.
Thanks, Elizabeth. I don't have a lot to add to what you said there, but what I think I would lift up in that was the experience of discovering and then writing about it in the piece, how on the one hand, as you said, there were certain individuals who were going to be left sort of as disposable, as you said, as collateral damage, you know, the ways in which support had been pulled away from people at a critical time and sort of hands had gone shrug, that's just what it's going to be in COVID. And then on the other hand, the ways in which mutual aid really for it to be done well, requires the entire community to take part in, and that mutuality that we saw happening, and the ways in which the key members of our community were the ones on the ground who often are marginalized, and yet were the keys to the successfully reaching out to one another. And so this flip side of the story that we experienced was that the leaders we needed were often the very people that were being sort of discarded at a systemic or structural level. Those were the leaders we needed most.
Thank you. And hey, Marianne.
So this is a sermon that was preached at one of the first weeks of our academic year last September at Emmanuel College. Miriam was very kind. After I preached, she thought, oh, this would be good to include in this inaugural journal edition. So I was totally gratified there. So, you know, I was, of course, you know, I was invited to preach even early summer or even before summer. And so I've been pondering upon the COVID pandemic situation and our school students and staff and faculty getting through this pandemic through a lot of challenges in terms of online, and you know, many students couldn't even join Toronto because border is closed. And so it's a kind of multi-layered impacts of the pandemic. So that was one. Second, I was involved with our college's so-called DEAR document about kind of stance on some of the issues, inclusion issues, accountability issues, and so on. That involving drafting that document, racism was, you know, such a key issue that our school and society in general are not deeply engaging, right? So I thought we should talk about this in preaching. And as you know, that racism and preaching are not really close friends, as far as I can tell, in terms of the research, in terms of the literature. So preaching is still a very white space. And yet here I am as a racialized, carrying racialized body, needing to address the issue. So there was already a vulnerability. And then in terms of the how to select the biblical text, as much as I admire and respect Revised Common Lectionary, you know, anything is perfect. So IDL has a problem in terms of not explicitly including the texts that are so-called problematic, meaning dealing with the deep questions, right? Mm-hmm. Song of Songs is one of such texts that is thought-provoking. First of all, it shows so many erotic expressions of love. And, you know, doesn't talk about God in any way. So it's an intriguing text. In terms of the race, you know, this is one of the texts that actually talk about skin color. Mm-hmm. And Black as beautiful. I mean, how many texts that has that, right? So it's a revolutionary text in my view. So my message was, on one hand, lift up the voices and the presence of people that haven't been fairly represented. And on the other hand, those folks are not just passive recipients or beneficiaries, but they are active kind of agents that challenge the status quo, dismantling the issues of racism and otherwise. And so I decide to lift up the voice in the story that apparently is a female voice, according to scholarly work. So not only is a Black woman in the Bible talking, mm-hmm. But it's a woman in the Bible talking. You know, that's another big issue. So the sectional issues. And then finally, you know, as a student, right, as a faculty, so doing the theological education, how can we kind of deeply honor and recognize the material living conditions? So it's not just about ideas, even though we do that in our work, that's a part of our job. But, you know, feeding food, the daily mundane work of getting up, cleaning, you know, those are so sacred and valuable thing that we should fairly, you know, recognize. So the fact that this woman in the Song of Songs are farm workers, right, who grow, produce food that probably we all benefit. So that's where I connected. So who would that be, that woman in the Bible today? and connecting with the migrant workers and the plight of the migrant workers, especially, you know, international temporary migrant workers in Canada are horrific. And you know, what we are doing to them is absolutely unacceptable. And yet I don't think we know, because we don't see them. And so part of the racism issue and, you know, disability ability issue that, you know, those are real people, but we don't, they are invisible, right? The society makes them invisible, right? So that we don't have to deal with, right? And so that's why this came about.
Wow. I am sitting here so glad we're having this conversation. So Amy, maybe you want to lead us into the first question, which connects to all of this.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Mir. So what we did when Miriam and I were sitting down 2 days ago, putting our heads together to think about how we wanted to approach these podcasts, we thought, well, why don't we ask some questions of the group and get a discussion going? What we tried to do is pull out some points of similarity between both of the pieces that you had, both of the pieces that you have written. So the first question that we want to ask you, it's a little long, sorry, it's the academic in us, so just bear with me as I read it. So the first question is, you've all written about how society, and in many ways the church, has seen and treated some people as quote-unquote disposable, especially during this pandemic. Elizabeth and Alexa spoke about the potential for triage care and how disabled bodies have been threatened by that. Hiran spoke about the injustice faced by migrant workers for a long time, and she highlighted how the pandemic has made vulnerable lives even more vulnerable. Why is it important to name this? And what should societies and faith communities be doing in the face of such injustice? So I'm wondering, would you be okay if Alexa and Elizabeth start us off and then we'll ask Hiran to go? Okay. So please, Alexa and Elizabeth, we had sent these questions to you in advance. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you got a chance to ponder over the past couple of days.
Yeah. Well, for us in our piece, we had used the metaphor of the body that Paul uses. And right now, you know, as we are gathering and talking, in the hospitals across the province and even across the country are being trained in how to triage the people that come into the hospital with COVID based on, you know, the probability of them surviving, in order that they might distribute like medical supplies, like ventilators, because we might get to a point where we don't have enough for everyone who's sick. And what our faith teaches us, right, is that we are one body and that the suffering comes to all of us when we think about disposing one of us. And that, you know, the recognition that that we live in this world where we do this, we triage people, and the intrinsic value of a human life, of a beloved child of God, isn't weighed in the same way. And yet what we saw in our experience of the Neighbors Helping Neighbors was the deep way in which we are interconnected, the deep need that we have for one another, the ways in which mutual aid tells a different kind of story about value and about how we can structure our society. And so it was at a time where these really deeply ethical questions are being asked, our faith can offer us another alternative way. And in fact, our lived experience in communities that are intersectional, that celebrate the gifts of all of its members. And what I loved about Haven's text of the Matthew 20 text that you brought in around the day laborers coming at different times, mm-hmm. and yet each one of them paid, right? And it mm-hmm. made me think when I was listening and when I was reading your text was about why those laborers didn't show up, right? Didn't go out to work. They say very clearly that that they weren't working because nobody had hired them. It didn't say they weren't working because they were, you know, lazy or they were doing something. They weren't working because someone hadn't hired them. And I began to think about the ways in which, you know, certain resumes that come with a name that isn't anglicized don't even get a phone call for the interview. And the ways in which, you know, we create this hierarchy and the counter narrative that many places of faith bring to the table. Part of why this journal is so important is it starts to tell a different story, one that's more life-giving for all of us, and one that we've been seeing play out both in the worst possible ways during the pandemic and in the best possible ways. Elizabeth, I wonder if you wanted to add to that in terms of our piece or...
I think what I would add is, this idea that I think it's been interesting to watch how faith communities in some ways I've been thinking about this a lot lately, more inclusive during the pandemic. So, I know we're all Zoom fatigued, but I think by opening up our virtual doors, we're including people that may not be able to get into our physical doors, either because Sunday service doesn't work for them, or our buildings aren't accessible, or, you know, people are hospitalized or looking after loved ones at home. And so I've been thinking a lot about how there are some really beautiful lessons from this pandemic. And I think one of them is that this door that's been opened up virtually, I hope it stays open. Of course, when we go back in person, that'll be a gift, but I hope that in hybrid, simultaneously with that gift, we'll be able to have this virtual door open. And I think about the ways that, it's really interesting to watch how communities have come together. Like there were people when I was involved with Neighbors Helping Neighbors who both were giving and receiving help at the same time. And sometimes the help that they were receiving was the ability to give help. And so just how we've been able to really build this collective of care throughout COVID as a church and as a broader society, although there's lots going on that isn't okay, there's some real beautiful things unfolding there.
Mm. Yeah, I appreciate both of you, Elizabeth and Alex's input here. So a couple things, just I don't believe in winner takes all.
Yes.
In that song. yeah. You know, and even if that's the world, it shouldn't be. And therefore, mm-hmm. we want to change that. And one way to change that is to pay attention to the groups and the folks who are overlooked, who are made invisible, mm-hmm. who don't given credit for that they are doing. So I often imagine a big conference or very glorious, successful event. And you know, all the keynote speakers and everybody just gorgeous, right? And their roles are important. I'm not discounting that roles. And often I'm in that. So I'm implicated in that. However, you know, those who bring food, those who cleaned up, who moves to this room, to that room so that we can run the conference, you know, those folks are, to me, a fabric of society that needed a better treatment and fair wage and all that. So, as Elizabeth said, you know, one of the ironic, paradoxical pandemic impacts is that those who haven't been hidden and overlooked, now exposed. Whether that's race, whether that's a disability, whether that's age, senior homes, or, you know, young mother with young children at home, you know. So how do we change, right, the world where winner take doesn't take all, but share equitably, is to name those folks and their roles and their struggles and their needs, not as a token of appreciation or, you know, charity, but as an equitable, just practice. So that's the reason why I think we need to name, and so biblically, theologically, academically, you know, our work should pay attention to, given an extra weight. Why? Because we haven't been doing it. So there should be a, you know, in terms of the symbolic way of saying it, penundrum went to one side already so much, it's imbalanced. So in order to make it balanced, we have to go the other way around a lot more. So, you know, that's one of the things. And then going back to the neighbor, helping neighbor article that you beautifully wrote, really, you know, one of the key terms that you're using, which is one of my favorite words, and I think Miriam and Amy might already know that I actually wrote a book on that term, interdependence.
And, oh, I'd like to read that book.
Yes, please do, and let me know. The very notion of the interdependence is not a, you know, some kind of ideal goal. I think it's just a necessity of life. I mean, so what kind of creatures, including the humans, do not have that? Like, we just can't live alone independently, not a single hour. Mm-hmm. Like, we depend on, you know, even non-human thing like desk and this computer, right? You know, we are having cup and water, and I mean, nothing is mine. Right, we are relying on, and so, you know, if that is just basic necessary of life and the truth of it, then we need to, therefore, neighbor helping neighbor, help each other when there is a need. It just, there's no brainer there, right? It just has to be the way to. However, as we know, we are not doing that, right? So certain people with power and wealth and whatever that may be are taking advantage of this so-called systems that are placed for the sake of those few dominant groups. And only way to sustain that is to keep the majorities of the folks at the margin, and make them invisible so that we don't have to deal with it, right? So to switch that, I think, you know, this kind of injustice issues through journal, through, you know, church work, through preaching, through writing, and, you know, protest and lobbying and policymakers, and just, you know, every factor, I mean, fabric of society should be making our world more equitably interdependent.
Yeah. I really like what you were saying there around the continued piece of it and the you know, larger piece of it, because one of the worries I have is we see these articles popping up now around the injustice that, you know, is being exposed because of COVID that was already there. You know,
yes.
One thing that really troubled me at the beginning of COVID was these agencies wanted to give me all kinds of money to help people in need. And they would say, who are you giving it to? And my answer was the same people I was going to give it to last week. Right? Like, it wasn't like there was suddenly this group of people that, mm-hmm. you know, that COVID made vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
They were already made vulnerable by systemic issues, right?
Yeah.
And so that one thing I worry about is as COVID fatigue sets in, right? And I see it in mm-hmm. myself, this level of exhaustion. I see it in the church community, that energy we had to right wrongs and support one another, right? That it mm-hmm. wanes as we become tired, and it wanes as the story leaves the media, and it wanes as we hear it over and over again, and we become acclimatized. At first, it's shocking, mm-hmm. right? The numbers of racialized people who are getting COVID, the neighborhoods right. that are right. That's shocking.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I wonder about and wrestle with, and I think you've been naming, Hayran, mm-hmm. is how do we keep that story? Then mm-hmm. how do we keep telling it? We preach it, we protest mm-hmm. it. You know, when one of us has run out of energy for it, somebody else has got it. And we keep that conversation. This podcast, right, will live somewhere online and someone will hear it and be fired up again by it, is the hope. Right.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly. I think that's a beautifully captured and one of the metaphors I use, and it's not just metaphor, it's I think daily practice, is that I think we have to rehearse
mm-hmm.
the reign of God.
Yeah.
As if the new world is here and now. And the rehearsal, as you know, if you're a musician, if you're artists or playwright, actors, they know how important to rehearse. Knowing is one thing, right? You have to mm-hmm. know how to do it is one thing, but to make it almost perfect, you have to keep practicing to the point that you are almost dying to do it, right? But that sense of rehearsal, I think as a body of Christ, I mean, the Paul's letter that you're using in your article is a beautiful symbol, but the body of Christ has to practice together mm-hmm. like the rehearse for mm-hmm. Theater or the music piece or whatever you're doing. And the sense of routine, the sense of the regular, the sense of the building up our muscle memories so that we pass that on. Mm-hmm. Even if we die, that this war continues. And finally, you mentioned something about hope. Often, even when the election happened in the U.S. and so on, people just appalled by whatever, and racialized communities or people who are marginalized are saying there's nothing new.
No.
Be surprised by it, mm-hmm. right? And so, for COVID, some of us, this is shocking, but many of them already know and nothing new, right? And
right.
So what that does is that we need to then therefore learn from them, like cues from those who are already making a difference and having a resilient, innovative, adaptive, flexible ways to get by, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here is the beauty of the life itself, right? Life keeps going. So that's why we don't have a luxury of not have hope, because we don't have option but be hopeful. And our, most marginalized, most vulnerable groups of communities, people are already doing it. And it's just a matter of us who are in, relatively privileged position, whether it's a gender, whether it's race and whatever, need to join that movement because they are already doing it. But if they don't take up, and doing together, then some might not make it because it's too hard to do it in small numbers. So.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that because I think you bring up a really salient point around the invisible labor of activism and advocacy. I mean, some activism is visible if you attend a protest, but all the organization and all the planning is invisible. And I think the daily advocacy that a lot of us do in our own private spheres just to manage our own support needs and to speak on behalf of and with and alongside our allies and communities. It's very emotional labor and it's invisible labor. And I feel like emotional labor is not even a good way to capture it. Unfortunately, I'm having the Friday afternoon slumps and my coffee cup's empty, but I feel like there's a word that I want to think about how to capture that invisible, weighty, emotional labor of advocacy that goes beyond unpaid and unrecognized, because it is that. But there's so much to managing when you're in a marginalized group, and I can only speak for my own, but I can imagine in other groups, there's so much to managing disability in the public sphere of life and in your own private sphere. And I just feel like, you know, I guess where I'm going with all this is I think it actually leads quite nicely into mental health, because I was thinking about like, how am I impacted by mental health? But I think the microaggressions and the systemic and structural violence that I talked about earlier, I think all that impacts our mental health, but we don't talk about it because we don't even know it's happening, because we're always in this mode of having to advocate and push forward and be strong. And so sometimes that phrase, like together we're stronger, I get it, but I feel like someone that takes up critical discourse analysis, I think about the discourse implied and I'm like, we are, but I think it's also okay to acknowledge that it's okay not to be strong all the time, and there's reasons that we're not strong all the time. I hope that makes sense.
totally makes sense. I think, Elizabeth, that leads into another question Amy and I had, is around how to cope with, for lack of a better word, that emotional energy this work takes. Both Amy and I have had struggles in the church and in academia, and we have questioned the reasons we see and the purpose of our work. A common theme for PhD students and all, but sometimes it's different for us because we have been hurt by so many things in the church and in theology. We are assuming that you've encountered similar questions and possibly very regularly. And so we ask, why do you say? And I think it has something to do with the rehearsal and the hope and the win of God. But I will let you, Haman,
there are so much emotional taxing going on, and that leads to, as Elizabeth said, you know, microaggression and internalization and, you know, all that. So I think we should just name that. That is just part of life. Any comfort would be that you are not alone. I'm not alone in it. So few things I guess we'll say here. There are unique gifts to offer in terms of PhD work. First of all, as you know, not everybody can do or will do. So given that, you know, if the society is like a fabric, I'm using that metaphor a lot today, and that the fabric has several threads and we are all weaving that threads together for the sake of well-being and wholeness. And PhD work is one of those threads that absolutely essential for the sake of the society's well-being. So that's a call that not everybody wants to or will. So I always think, why am I started this journey? And what motivated us in that journey? And that motivation, that desire, that intention, that love, hopefully will carry you. So that's one. The other one is that I meet people like you. If I were in that field, I would never met you, right? And again, we could meet in one of the church gatherings or something, but it's not same, right? So that the relationship is being formed and cultivated in a very particular moment, in a particular purpose. It's not same as meeting me, Miriam, meeting in World Council of Churches. It's not same. It would be wonderful, but it's not same. So I think I cherish that relationship being formed with that kind of a shared purpose and vision. And so you need to hang out with people that you love, people that you trust, people that you just feel good being together. You know, I always say I really don't like the term sacrifice. Even if the sacrifier meaning sacred, so there is that, you know, another good one. But in terms of the kind of feminist term of the sacrificing, because we are women, sacrificing, we are weak, whatever. I mean, and I advocate instead self-care. Because in other, but the self-care itself is not me alone. It's not a selfish in itself. It's a self as in relationship. So in order to be, you know, healthy enough for doing the work that we need each other, and that each other sometimes has to be very selfish. Like, you know, I don't want to hang out with you who driving me nuts because you are so racist. I don't want to hang out with people who are so misogynist and, you know, totally clueless about, you know, all this intersectional racism and oppressions. I don't want to, or queerness, you know, that I don't want to educate you about LGBTQ issue. I don't need that, right? Or mental illness or whatever. We don't need that. Sometimes we just want to be without needing to explaining why I'm here and just being with people who just know me and just accept me and just be, right? We need to do that. We need to cultivate that intentionally and again, regularly. COVID, I think it's even more urgent because we are isolated. We are detached. We are separate from our, you know, kin. And so that's that. So just find your best friends or whatever you call that group and just fully enjoy and cherish that. I think that is, I think, lifeblood. Without it, I don't think I can even begin to do what I have to do. So that's that. And third, I would say, tapping into creation. You know, we need to reach out to our kin that are not humans. Sometimes I think humans are hard to cope with. and but you know, the trees, to the animals that you have, and just being, you know, even the sound of the water, you know, mm-hmm. The warmth of the sunshine or the blessing of the rain. I mean, you know, those are, I think, deeply, profoundly, theologically spiritual. Mm-hmm. And we don't, I think, appreciate enough of those gifts that are given to us. And I think we need to deeply engaging them in a very contemplative, but also personally approachable. So you talk to the indigenous folks doing way better than us, I think. You know, really talking to them, right? And then you tell them and they somehow respond. And so just tapping in that. So when the situation is so dire, still we are not alone, and that God is with us in that sense of, anyhow, so it's not very, but I love to hear others.
I guess I'm thinking about like why we stay, you know, and why we take up the work we do. I think, you know, why I stay, there's certainly been hurt. I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that. But I also think that there's been a lot of community and joy that I've experienced being in that community. I think, you know, in terms of faith, I think that it's a little bit like a journey, right? And so I think it's, like you said, it's finding your people to be with. But I also, you know, I think for me, I stay because there is there's opportunity to share our gifts, whether that's, you know, doing things like this or singing in the choir or volunteering. So there's an opportunity to share your gifts and to be a part of that fabric or that interdependent community that you were talking about. And I think in terms of, you know, why a PhD, I ask myself that every day, but I think, I think it's because there's a story I feel more and more this every day. There's a story I need to tell and there's people that I want to hear it. I hope. And I think especially there's a story I want to tell outside of the disability space. I get asked probably once a week, why didn't you go to critical disability studies at York? And it's a fantastic program. I'm not at all disputing the great work that the folks at York do, but I think there's a story that I want to tell in a space where it hasn't been told. And I think there's a place to open up conversations where they haven't been opened up before, and to name things and claim things that haven't been said or that cause discomfort. So we silence them and we mute them. So, you know, things around care work traditionally cause people to feel uncomfortable and you know, or it belongs solely in healthcare, but it doesn't, because it affects every single one of us. And so I think why I stay is to try and weave that fabric a little tighter and tell that story a little louder and make that voice a little broader.
That question takes me and the comments to so many places, because I think thinking about the pain in the church, right? The body that is broken and hurts one another. And on the one hand, there's this internalized sexism that lives in me that, you know, is really, really hard to break. I have to consciously program, you know, recalibrate every time I walk into a room to not assume that the white man standing upright and able-bodied at the front of the room is the one in charge. I have to consciously do that, it's so maddening, right, that exists. Or, you know, the times that people have said to me, well, the front row, the front pew in your church is all going to be young men, as if my only value is what I look like instead of what I preach, right? So there is pain there. And yet on the other hand, in almost every other category, I'm a highly privileged individual. Right. And so when my voice is often invited into spaces and is considered really acceptable and you know, listened to. And so there's a lot of ways in which I get a lot out of this church of ours that you know, says, you go, Alexa, you're exactly what we're looking for, except you're missing a penis. But, you know, we'll let that go once in a while. And what keeps me here doing that work is this deep belief in that word that you mentioned earlier around interdependence, that my life is dependent upon and interdependent with the body of Christ, and that we all deserve better. The little girl inside me that got told, you know, she's nothing, and my, you know, sister who is queer, my best friend who is Muslim, my daughter who is brown, right? We deserve better. And that certainty that, right, holds me in this space. So then there's a calling aspect to the work as well. Called to do this work, called to decolonize my own mind, called to deconstruct the things that I have learned about myself and about other people and the variety of bodies that come into my life. And so while it's painful for me for a number of reasons, you know, one, the ways in which I've been hurt, but two, the ways in which I have hurt because of the ways I have been raised, right? And the shame that exists there is painful work to wrestle with. But the deep, deep, deep knowing that there is, that's where life is, right? That in interdependent work and in mutuality, that there's and you catch these glimpses of it every once in a while, right? And, you know, we work to rehearse it as you were saying, Hayran, and we, but there's enough of those glimpses and transformative moments, right? I've been with my church for 10 years at Windermere United, and there's been enough of those transformative moments that make moments like this one, which, you know, is a really difficult one. I'm actually struggling to be so disconnected from my community, the online piece of it. And yet, you know, these moments show up and we keep going because we know, right? We know that this is where abundant life is found. So what else can we do?
Yeah. Wow. I think we could really talk for hours and enjoy each other for hours. But I'm so grateful for all of your work and your commitment and your love for God's word that you share with me and Amy and with everyone else you meet. I wanted to just give you a quote that's been sitting in my heart today. And it talks about disability, but I think it's across all form of marginalizations. And so I will invite Amy to read this quote by A.H. Moon.
Sure. This is disabled practice. It's about interdependence. I couldn't do it alone, but I did it with her help. She needed flexible work, and I gave that to her. It's part of the ethics of care and support that so many disabled people show to one another. It's a kind of love that I hadn't known existed before my disability. It's fierce and patient and tender and rare. It's what disabled people give to one another because we wish the able-bodied world had given it to us. It's tinged with grief and pain and also with defiance. It's gentle and it's incredibly kind.
And I heard an answer in my work that feels impatient and tender and well loved that we put for today. And it's for me and for many Christians, it's, that's the love of God at work. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Amy, would you be comfortable emailing that quote out? I'd love to read it again and just think about it a little bit more. Is that something you'd be comfortable? Thank you so much. It's so beautiful, but I really want to sit with it a little bit more.
Definitely.
We will do that.
Yes, love to receive that as well.
Me too.